This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Years ago, a young black man gave a speech at a local competition about how African Americans can improve our lot in life. His message was familiar, delivered with verve and style. Develop your mind. Avoid teen pregnancy. Aspire to be more than an athlete or a musician. That speech killed at the contest, cheered on by an audience of black adults who loved what he had to say. But here's the problem. This young man later realized, much to his dismay, that the speech he gave was racist. It was delivered by a black man, cheered on by black people, but perpetuating the very stereotypes about African Americans that have persisted since the first slave ship docked in Virginia with about 20 enslaved people as its cargo. That happened 400 years ago this month. The fight against racism has come a long way, but there is still much to do. The FBI reports a 5-year upward trend in hate crimes. It's hard enough to fight racism, but scholar Ibram X. Kendi says the words we use and the ideas we purvey make it harder. That's just one lesson he's learned over a life of thinking about race and reflecting on his errors, including that speech all those years ago. Ibram X. Kendi is the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University here in Washington. American University owns WAMU, which produces 1A. His new memoir is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. Professor Kendi, welcome back to 1A.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts about fighting racism or your stories about what you found works or maybe does not work in fighting racism. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. I read your book, and it is a really fascinating look at the way that you have thought about racism over the course of your life as a young black man. Why did you start with that story? Because this is the story that opens the book.
Yeah. Well, I think first and foremost, it's probably the most shameful moment of my life. And in many ways, I think being an anti-racist is really being able to confess those shameful moments, those times in which we expressed to thousands of people a litany of anti-black racist ideas. And so I thought to sort of place the book in that type of way, I thought would be most effective. And I also know that really the heartbeat of anti-racism is confession.
Now, what was it about that speech, though, that's racist? I mean, I think there are lots of people who would say, yeah, you know, aspiring to get an education and, you know, to not father children you can't parent and to, you know, to do all of those pro-social things, there's nothing inherently racist about that.
So what makes the speech racist is I wasn't talking to an individual. I think individuals certainly should behave better. But when you're saying that to a group of people, in my case, I was speaking to black youth as a group, you're ultimately saying there's something wrong with black youth as a group. And to say that something is wrong with a racial group is to express racist ideas.
How did that speech perform in the competition?
I won the competition.
And how do you feel about winning?
I can understand how, because in the 90s, these ideas that there was something wrong with black youth were pervasive, were electrifying people. And for a black youth to stand up there and say it, it certainly, I think, caused people to like it for whatever reason.
Let's start with some basic definitions. And you begin each chapter of the book with a number of definitions. Let's start with this term, anti-racism. What is anti-racism?
Anti-racism is a collection, a powerful collection of anti-racist policies that lead to racial equity and are substantiated by anti-racist ideas. Anti-racist policies lead to racial equity, while racist policies lead to racial inequity. Anti-racist ideas express the equality of the racial groups, while racist ideas express that certain racial groups are better or worse, superior or inferior to one another.
Now, this is different, for example, from someone saying, I'm not a racist. So anti-racist, as I understand it from the book, is not the same as being non-racist. It sounds like one is active and the other is kind of neutral.
It is. And so, but the problem is that there's really no neutrality when it comes to between racist and anti-racist ideas. So you said, I said racist ideas express notions of racial hierarchy, anti-racist ideas, racial equality. There's no in-between neutrality in that. Racist policies lead to racial inequity. Anti-racist policies lead to racial equity. There's no in-between neutrality. And so what's actually happening when a person says, I'm not racist, is they're either consciously denying or defending their own racism, or I think for many Americans, they don't realize that they are saying a term, they're saying a line, I'm not racist, that white supremacists are saying right now. That Jim Crow segregationists said, I'm not racist when charged with being racist. That eugenicists said, when charged with being racist, their response was, I'm not racist.
So that term's got a lot of baggage around it.
It does. And I don't think many people realize the baggage that it has.
With regards to the baggage, just the R word itself has a ton of baggage, especially these days. Charlie wrote on our Facebook page, the issue is that the term racist is used erroneously, so it's lost its true meaning over the years. I've been called a racist solely because I'm white and for no other reason, like racism is an integral part of being white, which is a pretty racist idea in itself. Professor?
So again, I don't necessarily know whether he was called racist just because he was being white. But what I do know is it is in fact the case that the term racist has so many different definitions, which is why I wanted to be very clear on what a racist is and what a racist is not. And one of the, I think, biggest myths about the term racist is that it's a fixed category, is that it's a tattoo, is that it's who a person is. And that's how you have so many people saying, like, I don't have a racist bone in my body, because they think it's essential to who they are, when in fact it's a descriptive term. It describes when a person is saying something that's racist or doing something that's racist.
It's almost kind of like saying that someone's violent. You know, I may not be violent right now, but if I go outside and hit somebody in the face, I am being violent. It's more about what you do rather than what you are.
Precisely. And then if the next moment you're not being violent, you're being nonviolent, then essentially you're being different. And I think that's how we should be using the term racist and anti-racist, by describing what a person is doing in each moment.
So I just want to make sure we're clear also with the term, because we got a number of listeners who asked for like a real clear definition. The way that you are using this term is more about action, policy, word, deed, as opposed to the nature of one's humanity. It's almost like racist is as racist does.
Precisely. So I define racist in How to Be an Anti-Racist as someone who is expressing a racist idea or supporting a racist policy with their action or even inaction. And then I define an anti-racist as someone who is expressing an anti-racist idea or supporting an anti-racist policy with their action. So it's what a person is doing.
Speaking of what people are doing, we're glad to get your stories of what you are doing to actively fight racism. Adiyaha tweeted, since 2017, I've been leading a group of physicians to train doctors and other healthcare workers to become anti-racists in medicine. Physician implicit bias kills patients. Teaching doctors to recognize their implicit biases and actively work against them will save lives. Interesting that you share that with us, Adiyaha, because we've heard from a number of people who talk about the impact of how others' belief systems about outside groups can kind of wash over you and impact you in ways you might not have expected. Here's what Richard left in our inbox.
Richard, in northern Arizona, we have a tremendous population of Native Americans here, dozens of different groups from different backgrounds, different religious and spiritual perspectives, etc. Of course, they have been interacting much longer than we Europeans have been here. In my 20s, I felt very blessed to have been accepted by one particular group and exposed to progressively deeper and deeper beliefs and perspectives. Eventually, we got to the point that I was being exposed to really racial bias toward other tribes. And I actually adopted those as my own. I carried those with me, walked around with them, actually recited them to other people at times. And it was my wife who grew up here who pointed out to me that, hey, that's racism that you have adopted from another people's perspective.
Richard, thanks very much for sharing your story. And I think, Professor Kendi, the part of Richard's story that feels applicable to you is that you write in the book about kind of where you got your views from, that you are kind of marinated in the same system as everyone else. Like that speech that you gave, like where did all of that come from?
So, of course, in the 1980s and the 1990s, but even more specifically the 1990s, there were all of these ideas spreading around being produced about Black youth. So most notably, we've talked recently about the term super predator, right? But also there were ideas that Black youth didn't value education that was being produced by whites and even many elite Blacks. There were ideas that the reason why you had a growing percentage of children being born into single parent households is because there was something wrong with young Black mothers. There were all of these ideas, and obviously as a gullible teenager who didn't really understand the complexity of race in this world, I consumed those ideas and I ended up reproducing them as a senior in high school.
Speaking of the complexity of those ideas, we got lots of questions from folks about the complexity of these notions of race and racism. We'll answer as many of them as we can. Anne wrote on our Facebook page, I can't wait for this conversation. He, meaning Professor Kendi, he has been a big help for me when I was denying I had privilege. I just didn't understand it for a long time. How could I have privilege since I am poor? Also, a great help in my continuing goal to try to be a good ally. We'll get into some more of these nuances as we continue our conversation with Professor Ibram X. Kendi. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing fighting racism in a new way with this concept you may or may not have heard of, anti-racism. We're speaking to American University Professor Ibram X. Kendi. His new book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. We'd love to hear from you. Share what you know about what works or maybe does not work in fighting racism in your life, your community, your workplace, your family, where you are. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Also glad to get some of your stories about encountering racism in ways that may have surprised you. Anne wrote on our Facebook page, I've always known racism was alive and unfortunately well living in America, but really learned when I adopted mixed race twins. The evil is out there. I'd like to get back, Professor, to the comment from another Anne who wrote on our Facebook page. I'll read it again. Can't wait for this conversation. He has been a big help for me when I was denying I had privilege. I just didn't understand it for a long time. How could I have privilege since I am poor? Also, a great help in my continuing goal to try and be a good ally. Professor, could you dig into that link between race and privilege and the nuance therein?
Sure. And I actually think white poverty is a great place to discuss that, because it would make sense, right, that I'm poor, there's no way I can have privilege. But actually, when you compare white poverty to Black poverty, you find that white poor people are far and away less likely to live in neighborhoods with large numbers of other people who are poor than Black people. In other words, Black poverty is dense, while white poverty is more scattered. Take Chicago, for instance. A Black poor person is 10 times more likely to live in a neighborhood with high levels of poverty than a white poor person.
You also talk about that, historically speaking, in terms of the way that notions of race, this idea of race, kind of emerged as a way to define me by basically being not you, right? That we say, well, this is what those people are, and this is who we are, and this is why we get to be up here and they get to be down there, because, well, obviously, they're inherently, you know, less intelligent and less trustworthy and more shiftless and more lazy and basically more bestial. It was this way of allowing even the lowest on the totem pole to say, well, at least I'm not them.
Exactly. Because there are racial disparities across the board. There are disparities between, as we just mentioned, the white poor and the Black poor, between Black elites and white elites, between Black people and white people. And the question has always been, since the founding of this country, why do those disparities exist? And the answers have either been racist policies, which is what anti-racists have said, or there's something wrong and inferior about a particular racial group. Black people are twice as likely, a racist would say, to be unemployed because black people don't want to work. Black people are lazy, not racist policies.
You also talk about some of the terms we use to describe the problem. For example, in the book, you say that we should avoid or maybe stop using the term institutionalized racism. Why?
Well, it's a term that I've long used, but one of the reasons I've questioned whether it's a term we should use is because I don't think it's as exacting as the term racist policy. And also, racism, it's fundamentally institutional. But I think when we're talking about race, when we're having a racial conversation, we need to use terms and phrases that everyday people can understand quite easily. Because obviously, as you know, I mean, we're struggling to have this conversation. So the easier terms that we can use that still fill the complexities of this problem, I think the better.
Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire emailed, is racism not just like every other ism, capitalism, communism, socialism, Catholicism, Americanism, etc., and most importantly, tribalism? Once we pick an ism to attach to ourselves or others, tribalism takes over and we defend our ism to the exclusion of all else. This is exactly what Trump is using to rally and excite his base. He is baiting his followers using race, gender, ethnicity, and religion, their most ingrained tribal identities, to incite them to suit his needs. Perhaps we need less isms and more simple humanity. Professor, I think this is a comment I'd like to break into two pieces, but let's take the first part of it in terms of racism being like every other ism.
So I can't really assess whether it's like every other ism because I'm only a student really of racism. But I do know racist ideas specifically are a form of bigotry that operates very similar to other forms of bigotry, like sexist ideas, homophobic ideas. In other words, these ideas say that the problem is people, not policies and power.
He also, well, actually, in his description, he mentions capitalism, and you draw a historical link between racism and capitalism. You refer to them as the conjoined twins, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the history of both racism and capitalism, they emerged simultaneously in the same place, in the same space, and through the same mechanisms, through the transatlantic slave trade, through the emergence of slavery and colonialism. And it's not something that people want to recognize because just like we're arguing over definitions of racism, we're arguing over definitions of capitalism.
Well, and there also were levels of that have affected whites. You describe in the book how there was a point at which if you were Irish or if you were Italian, you weren't really considered white until, you know, blacks started to slowly begin to make our way up in the world. And then more European peoples were kind of wrapped into this definition of whiteness.
Yes, precisely. I mean, a century ago, the, quote, illegal alien, to use those terms, were Irish people, were Italians, were Russians, were people who were ultimately their people from their nations were either banned or reduced in the 1924 Immigration Act. But those white ethnics largely became white through the suburbanization of America in the 1940s, 1950s, and as you stated, through the achievements of black people who ultimately were fighting for equality, too.
We're speaking to Professor Ibram X. Kendi here at American University. His new book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. He's also the author of the National Book Award-winning book Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. He's the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center here at American University. We got a lot of your thoughts and experiences about dealing with or doing something that you later regarded as racist. Here's a little bit more of what you left in our inbox.
David, Lakeland, Florida. I recently made a racial comment that I didn't realize was a racial insensitive comment. I was in a dentist office, and my dentist is Asian American. And he was having a conversation with another Asian American. And when I got in the chair, I asked the dentist whether or not that was his brother. And instantly he responded and said, no, that wasn't my brother. Just like every other African American is not your brother. I was totally embarrassed and caught completely off guard as one who prides himself on being racially sensitive.
Growing up in the Midwest, racism was sort of ingrained into my upbringing, so I have obviously grown a lot since then and seen the error of my ways, but I can think of a few moments growing up, specifically one time where I told a younger classmate that I thought that interracial relationships were wrong, and she was obviously the product of one, and something that I think about, feel horrible about to this day. So to anybody who's ever experienced anything like that, I hope that listening to this, would they can realize that people grow and change, and obviously it's something that I cringe every time I think about. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for being willing to share your stories. I know these are not easy stories to share, so we appreciate all of you who have really shown up to kind of be very naked about what you've dealt with in terms of understanding racism. You talk about that as well, Professor, in terms of your journey, which began with your mom and dad, who were very thoughtful about these matters because they came up at a time when Black Americans were beginning to create a kind of scholarship around thinking deeply about the Black experience.
Yeah, and so my parents were raised and came of age during the Black Power movement, more specifically the Black Theology movement, in which as Christians, they believe that the church should be an engine of Black liberation. But ultimately, like other members of the sort of civil rights and Black Power generation, they ultimately moved into the Black middle class by the 1980s, by the time I was born. And by the 1980s, the question for them, just like the question for other new members of the Black middle class, was why are you in the Black middle class and other Black people are still poor? And so some members of the Black middle class answered that it's because I have worked harder. It's because I'm more intelligent. It's because the Black middle class is more hardworking and intelligent than the Black poor. And those ideas, demeaning the Black poor, were the types of ideas that I was nurtured on, that I think many people in the Black middle class were nurtured on, not realizing those were racist ideas.
You started punching back as like a 7-year-old. You were one of those, you were like me. You were one of those kids who was like, I got a brain, I can't shut it off. You talk about a confrontation in class with a Black girl who kind of timidly raised her hand and a white teacher who overlooked her, and you just weren't having it. What was that about?
I wasn't. And that's precisely what happened. And so after that incident, we had chapel service. This was a private school in Queens. And as we were leaving the chapel, after it ended, the teacher came upon me. I was sitting in a pew and asked me to leave. And I adamantly stated, I'm not leaving. And we went back and forth, her ordering me to leave, and I refused to leave. Ultimately, the principal came and did the same thing. And then finally, the principal asked me something that the teacher probably should have asked me from the beginning. What is wrong? And I told her what is wrong. And I told her what that teacher did. And I felt that was unfair. I didn't really know what racism was, but I knew what was unfair.
You even asked at one point why there weren't more Black teachers at the school.
Yes. It was quite obvious.
Which I'm sure blew everybody's hair back for a 7-year-old to be like, can I ask you a question? Where did that come from?
I think it was because, as my parents stated at the time, my parents had bought me this stack of biographies of famous Black activists, and I had sort of been reading them when I wasn't playing my Sega Genesis, and I really got to sort of understand what sort of Blackness meant and ultimately what injustice was.
And as you were trying to navigate this, where'd you find answers? Where'd you find guidance? Or did you find guidance?
So, I mean, I think I ultimately found guidance in experiences in which I heard other people say things that I realized I was saying. And when I heard them say it, I didn't like it. And then I had to reflect on, whoa, I'm saying that there's something wrong with Black people too. Maybe I'm a problem too. Maybe it hurts other Black people as it just hurt me when I heard another Black person say it. Or, of course, obviously I had a lot of formal and informal teachers over the course of my life, many of whom I talk about in How to Be an Anti-Racist.
Another message that was left in our inbox relates to something you described during your time as a student at Florida A&M University, which is the largest historically black college and university in the country. It's in Tallahassee, Florida. Here's what Margaret left in our inbox.
This is Margaret from Cleveland. I have relatives who have dark skin, and I have taught many students with dark skin. It occurs to me that if I were in their shoes, I would be offended by the constant use of the adjective dark as an acceptable synonym for evil, problematic, or scary, as used on TV and in newspaper accounts. It equates darkness with negativity and danger, and in doing so, it is a constant form of microaggression that people of goodwill should try to avoid.
Margaret, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. You talk about being at FAMU and dealing with just a very subtle microaggression of whether to date light-skinned girls or dark-skinned girls. Now, before you tell that story, define that term. What is a microaggression?
So a microaggression is sort of everyday racial slights and what I call racist abuse that are affecting black people each day. So when they go to have a barbecue in a park, the cops are called on them. Or when they try to move into their new apartment, somebody thinks that they're a robber. Or when they're on an elevator, somebody wants to, quote, touch their hair. These everyday regular things that black people are face as a result of other people's racist ideas.
Because it's just so exotic and I've never felt anything like that. And then all of a sudden they realize that their hand's been chopped off and they don't know why.
Yeah.
Things like that. Yes, just for those of you playing the home game, do not ask to touch somebody's hair. Do not touch somebody's hair without permission. We are not going to visit you in the ER. Just don't. Just don't. Explain the thing with dating light-skinned girls and dark-skinned girls. What was that about?
Yeah, so I ended up, the first woman that I dated at FAMU was a light-skinned girl, and my friends really were excited that I was dating this light-skinned girl. But then she had a best friend who was dark-skinned. And I came to really like the dark-skinned girl, particularly socially. And my friends would always contrast this beautiful light-skinned girl with the dark-skinned girl. And the more I heard them make that contrast, the more I felt bad about what I was seeing, the colorism that they were expressing. And ultimately, I stopped dating the light-skinned girl. And ultimately, I decided that I was only going to take dark-skinned girls at FAMU. And then I didn't realize at the time that I was inverting the hierarchy. And so I was putting dark-skinned women as superior to light-skinned women so I could compensate for so many people putting light-skinned women as superior to dark-skinned women, when either idea is a racist idea.
So the right thing to do would have been to walk away from the whole hierarchy.
Exactly.
To be like, I'm just going to date who I want to date, as opposed to, I'm not going to go for that preference. I'm going to make a different preference that works for me.
Precisely.
That must have been frustrating as hell for you. Coming up in a family with parents who were very culturally aware, and then matriculating at like one of the most woke schools in the whole country. I mean, there's a few on that par with FAMU. There aren't many like FAMU in the country. And wanting to grow and trying to grow and trying to learn and still screwing it up all along the way and being able to reflect it like, that was wrong. That was more wrong. Oh my God, I can't believe I did that. That had to be frustrating.
It is. But at the same time, when we think about how insidious and pervasive and normal anti-blackness is in this country, it makes sense. I grew up in these proud black spaces where there was still some layers of anti-blackness. And I think that once we have to get to a point as a nation, as a people, in which we recognize that any time we say there's something wrong with any racial group, we're expressing a racist idea. And that is fundamentally a problem. And we need to move away from that and recognize that the real problem is racist policies and power.
I want to continue talking about how we deal with those racist policies and powers. We continue with Professor Ibram X. Kendi on his new book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. I know that you have been dealing with your own health battles with colon cancer. I'd like to talk about that a bit. I also want to get to something that a number of our listeners have tweeted us about, including Lael Echohawk, who tweeted, "Come on, 1A, if we're talking about being anti-racist, then we probably shouldn't use phrases like low man on totem pole." I just used that one. Am I being racist? Stay close. Back now to our conversation with American University professor Ibram X. Kendi. His new book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. You talk in the book about where the X in Ibram X. Kendi came from, and you chose it as your middle name to replace the name Henry. First of all, what does the X stand for?
The X stands for Xolani.
Which means
peace in Zulu.
And why did you replace your middle name, Henry?
So I never really liked the name Henry, and no offense to all the Henrys out there.
Do not angry tweet us, Henrys. We don't want to hear none of it.
It was actually given to me. It was given to me by my father. It was one of our descendants was named Henry. But ultimately, really the first practitioner of racist policies in the world was also named Henry, Prince Henry the Navigator. He is the person who financed and organized the Portuguese beginning the process of exclusively slave trading in African people, beginning what became known as the transatlantic slave trade, and ultimately justifying those racist policies which brought wealth to the Portuguese crown by racist ideas, by saying these people were beasts, by saying we were going to civilize and Christianize these people.
Kevin tweeted, "What is the difference between equality and anti-racism? My daughters, who are Asian, experience racism from blacks, whites, and Hispanics. It seems too okay for them to be called a banana, and that isn't considered racist or racism because they're Asian." Professor?
Oh, I do think it's considered. It's a racist idea. If anybody is demeaned because of the color of their skin, because of their race, and when we qualify people by race and demean them, we are especially expressing racist ideas.
You talk about growing up in Queens and hearing your African-American friends say all kinds of awful things about classmates who are African immigrants, including those who are, I think, from Ghana?
From Ghana, yes.
What was that about?
Yeah, I tell the story. In eighth grade, we had one of the students in my all-black class was from Ghana, and we would demean him because of his Ghanaian heritage. We would at times in class chant refugee, 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 and do other things. And what I realized in retrospect is that in many ways, African Americans have consumed white racist ideas about Ghanaians, just as Ghanaian Americans have consumed white racist ideas about African Americans. And we have been repeating those racist ideas to each other for quite some time. And that kind of racism is what I call in the book ethnic racism, because really every ethnic group is also a racialized group. And in many ways, we've placed all of the ethnic groups on this massive hierarchy within the races. In other words, Cubans are apparently superior to Mexicans, and Nigerians are apparently superior or inferior to African Americans, and French are superior to Italians or inferior. And all of those are obviously problematic.
Was there a turning point for you at which you started to kind of settle into your current views on race and anti-racism? You talk about studying at Temple University in Philadelphia, which created, I believe, the first doctoral program in African-American studies. Was that part of the turning point for you?
I think it was towards the end, because I think by that point, what was critical there was first and foremost the recognition that notions of what we now call cultural racism, when people say that there's culturally something wrong with a particular racial group, that those are racist ideas too, and that we should be judging every culture from their own cultural standards, as opposed to applying our standards onto other people, that form of assimilationist ideas with racist ideas too. But then also I realized at Temple, through some very dynamic black queer women, that I had racist ideas about black women and racist ideas about black queers that I didn't realize were racist. And they, of course, challenged the entire graduate student community that they were not going to stand for any degrading things said about black women or about the black queer community.
But the interesting thing about the way you describe it is that I hear you in saying that they wouldn't have it. But the way they dealt with it wasn't just to say, hey, we won't have it. They would kind of shoot you with, what I've heard called as truth bullets until you just had to wave a white flag.
Yes. I mean, and the irony is I describe how Kyla and Yaba, I'm talking about Kyla's story and Yaba Blay, were as attacks. Like, I described how they were as attacks when really I felt that they were attacks, right? Because, when we believe something and believe something so deeply, and someone gently or even not so gently tells us how wrong we are, we view them as attacking us. When in fact, they're saying the truth of the equality of the racial groups.
Nature Nurture emailed, I wish more people could embrace abolishing the term race to categorize different cultural groups. You talk about this a little bit in terms of people saying that we should kind of stop viewing people as racist and just kind of view people as people, to just start to walk away from these hierarchies. But as you write it in the book, that can be problematic too.
It can. So that actually should potentially be the last, not the first step. Because if we stop categorizing by race, we're not going to be able to collect statistics on race, which means we're not going to be able to identify racial inequities. And if we can't identify racial inequities, how can we identify racist policies? And if we can't identify racist policies, how can we solve this problem known as racism? And so ultimately, in order for us to have a true conversation about not using the term race, we actually have to eliminate racial disparities first.
This is kind of a tough thing for the U.S. to be talking about right now. It seems like so much of our public discourse is just marinated in discussions of race and racism, including with regards to some of the things that President Trump has said and done. Last month, he made comments about Baltimore. He referred to people, good people on both sides of the Charlottesville protests in 2017, where, Virginia state troopers and a woman named Heather Heyer lost her life. This is something that the president said last month after speaking about Baltimore. He's standing near a chopper, so it's a little bit noisy, but here's part of what the president said.
I am the least racist person there is anywhere in the world. When con men, who I've known almost all my business life, because I had to deal with them, unfortunately, in New York, but I got along with them, Al Sharpton. Now he's a racist.
It's President Trump speaking last month after his comments about Baltimore. Let's set aside what the president said. We can end up in a deep rabbit hole as to whether or not Donald Trump is the least racist person there is anywhere in the world. I'm guessing some of our listeners would have a counter argument to that. So we're going to set that aside. But I'm interested in the political aspect of this. I mean, it just becomes dizzying at a point, and it's easy to just bop someone over the head and say, yeah, well, you're a racist. And the whole conversation just burns to the ground.
Yeah, and 2 years ago, what happened in Charlottesville, that Unite the Right rally was co-organized by Richard Spencer, who of course coined the term alt-right. What he also once said is that racist is not a descriptive term. Racist is a pejorative term. It is the equivalent, he said, of somebody saying, I don't like you. And many Americans, even Americans who are against the alt-right, who are against white nationalists, who are against President Trump, agree with him, agree that this is just a racial slur. It is just a term we use to attack people. But no, it's a descriptive term. It has a very precise definition. When you say that something is wrong with a racial group, you're being racist. When you do nothing in the face of racial inequities, which allow those racial inequities to persist and pass to another generation, you're being racist. When you support policies that reproduce racial inequities, you're being racist. So those three things, that's how you're being racist. And when somebody is doing those things, we should call them what they are, racist. And when somebody is expressing anti-racist ideas or creating policies that reproduce racial equity, we should call them anti-racist.
The conversations about this are also very nuanced, very complicated. I think a lot of Americans are kind of learning this or relearning this for the first time, which in itself is positive, right? Because we're thinking about it. But it's easy to step in onto a landmine. A number of listeners have written what Lael Echo Hawk, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, tweeted, come on, 1A, if we're talking about being anti-racist, then you probably shouldn't use phrases like low man on the totem pole. Now, a number of listeners in the last few minutes have messaged us about that. Apparently, I said that in some context. Forgive me, I don't remember exactly what. But if plenty of listeners said that I said it, then I probably said it. Now, I get that, that there is validity to this idea of not using that term. It's a common colloquialism. It's something that's been in the lexicon forever. Low man on the totem pole is not, you know, accurate to the history of how totem poles have been used by Indigenous peoples and First Nations. But on the other hand, damn it, really? I'm the problem? Like, come on, guys. We're having a whole hour conversation about anti-racism, and you want to throw spitballs at me because I use a term by mistake. So I see where they're coming from. I'm also highly ticked, and I don't know how to navigate that.
Well, I think one of the singular messages that I try to put forth in how to be an anti-racist is, as an anti-racist, we should be fundamentally concerned about outcomes. And that is across the board. So in other words, you know, many people say that they agree with Malcolm X's phrase, by any means necessary, but they really don't believe that. Many people say that they want to persuade and encourage people to be anti-racist. But if at any point someone says something that is in some ways insensitive, they attack them as opposed to educate them. And so if the goal, if we're focused on the outcome, if we're focused on changing minds, changing power, and changing policies, then that is where our focus needs to be. And when the people we're working with, or even the policies we're working with, or the powers we're working with have missteps, we should fundamentally figure out, okay, is that a misstep, or do we need to replace them? And it's a very slippery sort of slope.
But do those listeners have a point, though? I mean, I have a national platform, so if I am propagating that expression, it allows it to continue to live in the public consciousness.
And the question is always, you, for instance, I think, and I think this was different than what many people do, I think you acknowledged, first you brought it up, then you acknowledged that in some ways it was problematic, that it was problematic. And that is the key. So we as anti-racist, like, we are going to constantly make mistakes. Like, I am not an anti-racist. I'm only striving to be one. I'm striving to be one on an everyday, every moment basis. And I recognize that because I've been trained to think that there's racial hierarchy, that there's something wrong with groups of people. I've been trained in so many oppressive colloquiums. I know I'm going to eventually say them. The question is, will I acknowledge that? Will I confess that? And will I strive to change that?
Before we let you go, I want to talk about where you're heading now, what's next for you. You end the book with a description of your fight against stage 4 colon cancer. And you use that to kind of thematically link it to the fight against racism in the U.S. First of all, how are you? How are you doing now?
I'm doing fine. So my body was scanned about a month ago, and it all looked clear.
Tell me about that link. You talk about, and I want to get this right, I'm going to try and find it from the end of the book really quickly in the way that you phrase it. You write near the end of the book about the line, the link between racism and cancer and the nature of how we fight them both. I have cancer, the most serious stage. Cancer is likely to kill me. I can survive cancer against all odds. My society has racism, the most serious stage. Racism is likely to kill my society. My society can survive racism against all odds. Elaborate on that link of the cancer of racism and how you see it.
Sure. So there's two parts, I think, to the link. And I think you just read from one part. And that is, you have people who either deny that they have cancer, or I should say that America has racism, which obviously is only going to make the disease worse. Or you have people who deny that America can survive racism. And both of which is not going to allow us to fight, to truly fight, to truly get America to a point in which we could survive. And the way we fight racism is actually like the way we fight cancer. Typically, what doctors do is they have a local treatment in which they go in and surgically remove racist policies because they recognize they're a problem. And then when they take those out, they also flood the body with chemotherapy, with the chemotherapy of anti-racist policies that create racial equity, that eliminate any sort of cancer cells of racial inequity. And then what do? They watch the body very, very closely to make sure there's not a reoccurrence.
So before I have to let you go, what would you say in terms of our treatment should be one of the next courses of action if you could have your pick before we got to go?
Well, I think what you're already doing, I mean, those people who called in to sort of share and acknowledge some of the times in which they have expressed racist ideas, that is the first step for us to stop being in denial, for us to acknowledge and confess who we've been trained to be. And then the next step, of course, is taking the journey to be anti-racist, learning what it means to truly see the racial groups as equal, to truly see the problem as racist power in policy, recognizing that we can see difference and see equality, that we don't have to place difference on a hierarchy.
American University Professor Ibram X. Kendi, the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center. His new book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. Professor Kendi, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
This program was produced by Bianca Martin. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.